Myers. Good afternoon, everyone. It's good to see all of you here. I had the pleasure of being here about, as Mr. Myers said, about a year and a month ago. I think I was here the week before Thanksgiving last November. I was commenting about, I think you had a very early winter that year, and I was commenting about the snow, being from South Texas, that I hadn't seen snow in many, many years. That's the first time I'd actually seen snow falling. I'd seen snow on the ground, but first time I'd seen it falling since I was in, back when the dinosaurs ruled. That would be back when I was in about the seventh grade. It was such a big thing in Texas that, and I'm in South Texas, that they let school out for the rest of the day so that we could enjoy the snow. And then we went to Cincinnati. I presented the Noah's Ark Seminar in Cincinnati at the family weekend last year, and that was a very cold winter from what I understand. Had a lot of snow and had an opportunity to see snow then. We drove from Corpus Christi. My wife, my better half, is here. She's sitting here in the third row. We drove from Corpus Christi, left Thursday afternoon at 4:30, and got here yesterday evening around 7 o'clock our time, 8 o'clock your time. So we were in the car for about 26 hours, 27 hours. So we had a nice long drive. Then we're going to drive over to some church friends in Pennsylvania, and then from there we're going to drive back to Cincinnati to attend the family weekend next weekend, and then drive back to Corpus Christi. So we have a full week ahead of us. All three of my children will be there, but because they have to work. I don't work during the break, but my wife also works in school, so we have a little more free time than they do. But since they're working, they're going to be flying up on Wednesday, and we'll be seeing them on Wednesday. Now, before the seminar starts, let me tell you a little bit about how to get in contact with me. I often have people that want to know how to contact me. I have my own web site and web page. My email address is acm@arnoldmendez.com. And if you'll email me, I'll send you the directions, the URL for my website. And also up here, I have some information that you might want to peruse and look at during the break, and we'll be talking about that a little later. As Mr. Myers said, we're going to talk for about an hour and 15, hour and 30 minutes, have about a 5 or 10 minute break, and then we're going to have questions and answers. If you have a question that pops into your mind, please write it down. I cover a lot of material. I go here and I go there, and you may have a question, and I've had a lot of people after I'm home saying, I was going to ask you this, but I forgot. So we'll have a question and answer. So go ahead and write the questions down that you have, and then during the question and answers, we'll go ahead and answer those. Brethren, either evolution is correct or this book is correct. Now, I didn't say science, but I said either evolution is correct or this book is correct. And a lot of people in the church, they ask about the fossil record, and they wonder about the fossils. The fossils, for example, that the Leakeys are digging up or have been digging up and have dug up. They just found another one back a few months ago called Flat-Faced Man from Kenya. That's what the fancy scientific name means. And many people wonder about the fossils. And the problem is not the fossils. The problem is not the fossils. You have a fossil here. KNMRER-1470 is a scientific name for it. But it's a fossil of a human remain that was found, supposedly about 3.8 to 2.8 million years old, depending on which scientific journal article you believe or you read. But the problem is not the fossils. The problem is the interpretation that you put on the fossils. That's the biggest problem with the fossil record and the way that sometimes we in the church look at it. We look at the fossils and we believe that the fossils support evolution. In reality, the fossils do not support evolution. The fossils support creation. Now, most scientific interpretations of the fossils support evolution, but they're different. An interpretation is not the same as the actual item. That fossil could be interpreted to show, and I'm going to show you that before the seminar is over, that fossil could be used to show that man has not evolved and that man is not as old as people think and that the Genesis record is correct. I'd like to read you a few quotes about human evolution, and I'm going to be talking about science today and about evolution, and I kind of use terms loosely and in general, and I want you to understand when I'm talking about scientific information and how it deals with this subject, I'm basically talking about evolutionary science. So bear that in mind. There's a lot of good science, but there's also a lot of bad science. Science, evolutionary science, and the Bible are directly opposite and contrary towards each other. And you have to understand that. Let me read you a couple of quotes. This is by G. Richard, The Meaning of Evolution, in a journal, in an article by the American Atheist, February 1978. He says, Christianity is, must be, totally committed to the special creation as described in Genesis, and Christianity must fight with its full might, fair or foul, against the theory of evolution. It becomes clear now that the whole justification of Jesus' life and death is predicated on the existence of Adam and the forbidden fruit he and Eve ate. Without the original sin, who needs to be redeemed? Without Adam's fall into a life of constant sin terminated by death, what purpose is there to Christianity? None. What this all means is that Christianity cannot lose the Genesis account of creation. The battle must be waged, for Christianity is fighting for its very life. Christianity has fought, still fights, and will fight science, evolutionary science, to the desperate end over evolution, because evolution destroys utterly and finally the very reason Jesus' earthly life was supposedly made necessary. Destroy Adam and Eve and the original sin, and in the rubble, and I'm quoting, you will find the sorry remains of the Son of God. Take away the meaning of his death. If Jesus was not the Redeemer who died for our sins, and this is what evolution means, then Christianity is nothing. Sometimes we want to marry evolutionary science and the Bible, and you cannot do that. Let me read you another quote. The most important responsibility of the geologists involves the effect of their findings on the mental and spiritual lives of mankind. What you believe affects how you live. Early geologists fought to free people from the myth of biblical creation. Many millions still live in mental bondage controlled by ignorant ranters who accept the Bible as the last word in science. Also, the theory of evolution greatly affects modern thinking. Man's rise from the simple life forms even today causes much controversy among fundamentalists, quote, who claim to a literal belief in the Bible. And this is by Dorsey Hager, 50 Years of Modern Geology, published in GeoTimes. George Sim Johnson, The Genesis Controversy, published in Crisis, May 1989. In other words, it's natural selection or a creator. There is no middle ground. I'm quoting. This is why prominent Darwinists like G.G. Simpson and Stephen Jay Gould, who are not secretive about their hostility to religion, cling so vehemently to natural selection. To do otherwise would admit the probability that there is design in nature and hence a designer. And I have a whole bunch of them, but I'm just going to read you a couple of more. This is by William B. Provine. Title of the article, Scientists Face It! Exclamation point. Science and religion are incompatible. True science and true religion are very compatible. The Genesis account and evolutionary science are incompatible. And you need to understand that. When I talk about science, I'm not talking about the scientist that fixes your teeth and the man that grinds your lenses for your glasses. I'm talking about people that come up with theories that say that you are descended from monkeys. The implications of modern science, however, are clearly inconsistent with most religious traditions. Let me rephrase that. The implications of modern evolutionary science are clearly inconsistent with most religious traditions. No purposive principles exist in nature. Organic evolution has occurred by various combinations of random genetic drift, natural selection, Mendelian heredity, and many other purposeless mechanisms. Humans are complex organic machines that die completely with no survival of soul or psyche. No inherent moral or ethical laws exist, nor are there absolute guiding principles for human society. The universe cares nothing for us, and we have no ultimate meaning in life. That's what evolutionists will tell you. And some of us want to read their material and say, maybe, possibly, there's something that I can glean out of that. What you can glean out of reading evolutionary literature is the fact that evolution is a philosophy, and it's biased. It's extremely, extremely biased. What I'm going to do today is several things. I'm going to show you that the Genesis record, as it is written, is largely correct. by and large, correct. I'm going to show you that evolution is a philosophy, that the Genesis record and evolutionary science are contrary and contradict each other. They have to be, because they're based on different philosophies. And I'm going to show you that the fossil record, that the actual fossils themselves support very well the fossil record. I believe in a creation. Why? Because I have faith. No. Let me ask you a question. And I was driving down from Texas last couple of days, and I'm not sure what city it is, but somewhere around here, there's a General Motors plant that makes Corvettes. And I think all the Corvettes are manufactured in that plant for the United States. What's the name of it? Bowling Green, Kentucky. Yes, sir, it is. We passed it on the way, driving down up the interstate. Do you need faith to believe that a Corvette has a designer? No. You just look at the Corvette and you say, this intricate machine has been designed. Your body is more intricate and more complex. The simplest, small, single-celled organism, and simple is a misnomer, but you understand what I mean. I'm speaking the vernacular here. The simplest celled organism is more complex than your computer. What would you do if I told you, this computer that's in my office? It just sort of, over the course of time, formed and fashioned itself. You would think there was something wrong with me. I want you to consider something. You have a brain, and in your brain you have neurons and electrical connections. You have many, many of these. Do you know that if you took all of the trees in North America and you counted all the trees and then you counted all the leaves in each of those trees, that your brain has more electrical connections than that number? You are extremely complex, and someone has designed you. Now, before I go on, I've been researching the subject for about the last 20, 25 years. I've helped edit a couple of booklets that the church has put out. One is, Does God Exist? Life's Ultimate Question Here. And also, Creation and Evolution. Does it really matter what you believe? And also here, I have some works cited from scientific journals, articles, and literature. You don't have to go to the creation literature to find support for the Genesis record. You can go right to the evolutionist literature. You can go to the journal articles that the scientists themselves are writing. I talked about that this morning a lot when I talked in the sermon that I gave in Youngstown this morning. And this has more than 80 pages with about 10 or 15 citations from scientific journal articles showing support for the Genesis record and for evolution. I also, if I don't forget, this CD here is Noah's Ark and Early Man Seminar. It contains all the information that you're looking at, all the posters, and all the material that's in these binders that I put together. Here's a binder on the fossil record of early man. What does the scientific literature reveal? Here's one on various scientific journal articles about fossil man and evolution. And here's one on the Genesis flood and early man, answers from the Bible and science. All of those are in here. I'm going to leave this with Mr. Myers, I think, for your church library. So feel free to come and make copies of this and peruse the information on it. It also has some real player seminars of some seminars I've given in various places, including Houston, Texas. So feel free to use those. The reason I'm telling you this is that this seminar that I'm giving you is very well researched, and it has a lot of information from the scientific journal articles themselves. Nature, Scientists, and all these other prestigious journals are extensively cited in the information that I give you. So in the seminar, I'm going to be saying, you know, they say a lot, but just be aware that it is very, very well researched and very, very well cited. Now, if evolution, or let me ask you a question. When I ask you, or when we talk about evolution, what do you think? The problem is most people in the church do not understand what evolution is and how it works. So let me tell you a little bit about evolution, how it works, and then you can understand the mechanism by which people say we have arrived at where we're at today, physically and organically. Now, according to evolution, you had a simple-celled organism here, and through time and changes, this simple-celled organism became very complex. We have descended from simple-celled organisms in the seas through a series of changes, mutations, and time down into Homo sapiens, which is us. Now, evolution needs two things to work. Evolution needs time. They need lots of time. And evolution also needs changes. If I take the biological material, your DNA, or this amoeba, or this simple-celled organism's DNA, and I slowly alter it so that the descendant is now a little bit different, and I keep making subtle changes through mutations, genetic recombination, all these other types of things, then with time, these changes become accentuated, and we have a new organism. So you have to remember, in the fossil record of early man, and in the fossil record of any organic organism, you have two things. You have time, and you have changes. You have lots of time, because mutations and changes to your genetic material occur very infrequently. And in order for you to change, in order for you to do what the evolutionists say, which is to become or to change from a single-celled organism into a complex human being, you have to have a lot of changes over lots of time. So that's the first thing you have to understand, is that evolution requires time. We're talking in millions, hundreds of millions of years, or in some cases billions, and it also requires changes to your genetic material. And this is done through a process of mutations. Now, as far as early man is concerned, what happens, or what supposedly happens, is you have the early mammals here. And then the mammals change with time, and the genetic material changes, and you have, to speed the process up, you have Australopithecus afarensis and Africanus. Right here, I have a skull cast of AL444, which is a specimen discovered in Africa. And he is about 2.5 to 3.5 million years old. This is Australopithecus afarensis right here. It's an actual cast. He has been around, supposedly, and when I use these time periods, remember that I'm giving you the evolutionary time periods, not the biblical time periods, because even if you use the evolutionists' own fossils and you use their own times, they're inconsistent with each other. But you have Australopithecus afarensis, who existed about anywhere from about 4 to 2.5 million years ago. Some people say 4 to 1.5 million years ago. And then with time, Australopithecus afarensis evolved into Homo erectus. Homo means man. Erectus means upright. So it just means man that stands straight tall. That's all that means. I have here a skull of Homo erectus. He's right here. All right. This is an actual skull. This is called Peking Man, discovered in China, some of the caves in China. And it's actually a composite because, you know, they didn't find the whole skull. They found pieces and particles of it, and they put it together. So there's a lot of artistic liberty that goes into the interpretation of what he looked like. So you have this, and this is Peking Man, Homo erectus. And he's about, 2 million to about 1 million years old. And there's a lot of variation in these, but that's the generally accepted years. And then Homo erectus, with changes and with more time, evolved into either Homo neanderthalensis, or Neanderthal man, or Homo Homo sapiens. And some people put Homo sapiens after Neanderthal man. Depends. There's a lot of controversy even among the anthropologists. And all of this here takes place within about the last 500,000 years ago. So in order to understand human evolution, you have to understand the dating of the fossils. You have the early mammals, which they're not sure if it was a mouse or a shrew, mouse-like animal. And about 4.5 million years ago, Australopithecus came on the scene. The Leakeys have discovered flat-faced man from Kenya, who's about 5 million years old. So he supposedly is up here, but we're not going to even talk about him, because they'll find another one before him later on. And so you've got Australopithecus here, you've got Homo erectus here, Homo neanderthalensis here, a Neanderthal man, and then Homo sapiens. The evolutionists talk about your family tree. He gave rise to him, and so forth and so on. Now, this is based on certain assumptions. The assumptions are that the fossils themselves are very easy to categorize. All right. The other is that they stay within their time ranges. In other words, let's say, for example, that this lady over here is your grandmother. You introduce her to your friend, and you're about 35 years old. And you introduce your grandmother to your friend, and your grandmother's 18. You see the problem? How can your grandmother's 18 give rise to you if you're 35? So, Australopithecus afarensis and africanus have to be older than Homo erectus to give rise to Homo erectus. Everybody with me on that? And Homo erectus has to be older and precede in time Homo neanderthalensis and Homo sapien. If we find a Homo sapien fossil, and we're going to fantasize here, if we find a Homo sapien fossil that's 5 million years old, according to the evolutionary time frame, what does that do to their theory? You see the problem there? That's like saying, my grandmother's actually younger than I am. Now, they have all kinds of ways of gyrating out of this, and they do all kinds of intellectual gymnastics to get out of this. Usually what they'll do is they'll assign this fossil another category or another name, or else they'll say that the fossil is an anomalous fossil, which means it's been found out of order or it's fallen into other strata. Or they'll say that there's been a problem with this interpretation or a combination of the three. They will never say, oh, yeah, we have Homo sapien fossils that are 5 million years old. Now, if I take a human hand bone, whatever, finger bone, and I dig in the ground, and I dig in strata that's 8 million years old, and this is all conjecture, speculation, and I find a human hand bone that's 8 million years old, that tells me that all of these other fossil men cannot be ancestral to man. It's a very important concept, the one that you have to understand. If you're taking notes, you need to understand and write down that the fossil men appear in a certain order, in a certain time, and in certain strata. You have to understand that to understand the concept of fossil men. Now, another thing you have to understand is that scientists are extremely biased. Extremely biased. You tend to think that scientists are very objective, and they are not. They're extremely biased. I covered some of this in my Noah's Ark seminar I gave here about a year ago. Scientists are extremely biased. Read the literature and the journal articles. And they have fights and squabbles among themselves. Now, if in 1977, when I was much younger, but I was still an adult then, if I had told Leakey, who had dug up Zingianthropus, who was Nutcracker Man, that he was simply looking at an orangutan or an extinct ape, everybody would have said that I was ignorant and had a theological axe to grind. That was in 1977. You know what they've discovered since then? They've discovered that Nutcracker Man is an extinct ape. And that Leakey was wrong. And that all the creationists at the time were correct. And the reason being is because there's more evidence that's come forth to show that obviously Nutcracker Man was an extinct ape. And you can use that same kind of reasoning, same kind of logic to show that most of the fossil men that they're digging up that supposedly are millions of years old are actually just misinterpreted. And the reason they're misinterpreted is because scientists, you can discover the world's oldest onion and nobody cares. You can discover the world's oldest tree and nobody cares. But if you discover the world's oldest human ancestor, the prestige and the fame and the glamour are inexhaustible. And you have to understand that there's a lot of bias, there's a lot of egotism, and a lot of philosophy in science. Evolution is actually a philosophy because it cannot be falsified, which means that you can't, no matter what fossil you bring that's showing that evolution is incorrect, they're going to manipulate the evolutionary theory so that that fossil does not apply to it. And there's a lot of that that goes on in science. Now, if you'll take your Bible, and let's open our Bible to the book of Genesis. And we're going to look at some things that the fossil record and the book of Genesis talk about. The first thing is Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. These are some of the concepts you need to understand before we can go forward with the understanding of fossil man. In verse 1, chapter 1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. We read right over that, and we don't realize what we're reading. God, in the beginning, creates the heavens and the earth. Then the earth became, as it should read, it's the word haya, H-A-Y-A-H. It means to become. You know where it says man became a living soul, or living nephesh? The word became is haya, the same word is used there. But here it's translated was, when it should be translated became. The earth became a wasted, confused dump. And you can analyze this, go back to the Hebrew and go to the other places in the Bible. It talks about war in heaven, destruction and all those things. And what you come to understand, and the church's position and teaching on this, is that there was a world that existed before the world of Adam. And this world was destroyed. And this world, when it was destroyed, God then took the earth and in 6 days refashioned it and recreated it to allow it to be a fit habitation for man. That does not mean that there were man-like creatures that existed before Adam. I didn't say that. I said that there was a world before Adam. We call it the Triassic, Jurassic, and Mesozoic eras and periods. It was the world of the dinosaurs. And verse 2 is another concept. And the earth was without form and void, or had become wasted and confused, and darkness was in the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. If I asked you the following question, you would answer once. How many times has the earth been covered by water? Once. Flood of Noah, Genesis chapter 6, 8 and 9. Had a whole seminar on it last year, right? Actually, that is correct, but there's another time it's been covered by water. And you can read about that right there in verse 2. It says, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And you go on to read where God took He created land and then He separated the land. So obviously at this time the earth was covered by water. So you had a decayed world that existed before Adam. It was covered by water. God, through various processes, cleaned off the surface of the earth, lifted it up, made it habitable for man. Then it was destroyed again during the flood. So the second concept that you have to understand, actually there's three. First, the scientists are biased. Second is that the earth had a prehistory before man. And the third is that the earth has been covered several times by water. And each time it was covered by water, it was destroyed. So you have a ruin built up on ruin. And it's very hard to interpret the record and come to understand some of the things that we're going to. Now, another thing is, let's look at Genesis chapter 4. This is a couple of generations removed from Adam. Genesis chapter 4. Verse 22, we tend to think that the people before the flood were ignorant, nincompoops. And they were very, very intelligent. Notice Genesis chapter 4, verse 22. And as for Zillah, also she bore Tubal-Cain, an instructor of every craftsman in bronze and iron, and the sister of Tubal-Cain was Naamah. Did you catch that? He was an instructor and he worked with bronze and he worked with iron. This was before the flood. You had men that knew the process of smelting down metal. And it says later that Cain built the city. And it says later that Noah built an ark. The men before the flood were extremely intelligent and very technically advanced. Now, they didn't have the knowledge we have now, but they were not running around in living in caves, dressed in bear clothing and bear skins. They were very, very intelligent. That's one of the things you have to consider, is that they were very intelligent. And there were cities being built. There was metal being smelted. And there was the ark being built. And I gave you a seminar about the ark. Now, I want you to notice something in verse 22. As for Zillah, she bore Tubal Cain. And this is a corruption. And if you really look at the primary languages, Tubal Cain is actually a corruption of Vulcan, or Vulcan is a corruption of Tubal Cain. Everybody know the old mythological heroes that were around. One of them was Vulcan. What did Vulcan do? He lived in the bottom of a cave, in the bottom of a volcano. That's where we get volcano from, Vulcan. Vulcanizing rubber using heat or fire. And what did he do? He worked. He's the one that the gods gave the knowledge about working metal, and then he gave that knowledge to man. And this is actually talking about some of those things that we think are prehistory that are really not, that the Bible talks about. And you can make a whole study about that. Tubal Cain was actually Vulcan, a Vulcane. And he was the one that worked with brass and iron, the god of the underworld. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later when we go to Genesis chapter 6. And these were the heroes, the men of old, the men of renown that the Bible talks about. Now, I want you to think about something else. We tend to think in today's terms. You know, you live to be 70 years old, you die, and that's it. Back in the times of Adam and even the times of Abraham, and we'll look at that, people lived a very, very long time. Now notice what it says in Genesis chapter 3, verse 14. They would have lived longer except for the following, chapter 3, 14. So the Lord said to the servant, because you have done this, you are cursed more than all the beasts of the field. The beasts of the field were cursed. And the snake was cursed more, but the beasts of the field were still cursed. Why were they cursed? Because of Adam's sin. They were cursed. There was a curse that was brought on the earth. Notice 4:11. And this is talking to Cain. And so now you are cursed from the earth, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. Cain was cursed. Notice 5:29. And he called his name Noah, saying, this one will comfort us concerning our work and the toil of our hands because of the ground which the Lord has cursed. So the earth was cursed. All right. If you go back to Revelation, to the last chapter, and I think Revelation 22, verse 1, 4, around there, it says that there's going to be no more curse. We start off with the earth being cursed. Man lives in the earth. He's living in a cursed place. And then at the end of the story in Revelation, the curse is removed. That curse affected a lot of things. One of the things it affected was longevity. Now notice, let's go to Genesis chapter 5. Genesis chapter 5. In Genesis chapter 5, it has the genealogies of who begat who. And it's not necessarily talking about the firstborn son, but it is talking statistically about children that were born. And if you look at the firstborn and how long they lived, you come up with two things. One is that people before the flood were living a long, long time. You know, Adam lived 930 years. Methuselah lived 969 years. Noah lived 950 years. And a lot of people come up with all kinds of theories about why, how these figures came to be. You know, the cycles of the moon and the solar cycles were not correct and the chronologies were not correct. How about we just believe the Bible? So people were living a long time, and they were giving birth to their firstborn, or to the first mentioned born, later. And if you go to Genesis chapter 11, just go to Genesis chapter 11, and notice in verse 10, the genealogy of Shem, and all these people. These were people born after the flood. And if you'll do a statistical study of them, you'll notice that the people didn't live as long, and that their firstborn, or the first mentioned son or daughter, was born earlier. So we have a couple of things. One is, before the flood, you have people that were living longer, and then they were giving birth or maturing at a later age. So this is Genesis chapter 5. This is how long they lived. And this is when they had their first son. And I'm graphically representing this. This is Genesis 11, after the flood. And they lived a shorter amount of time, and they gave birth to their first mentioned son at a shorter time. That's very interesting when you start looking at the skeletons of these various fossil men. Now, let's look at some other things. Let's look at Genesis chapter 17. Genesis 17. We're going to look at Abraham's life as an example, and you can do this with all the patriarchs. Genesis 17, verse 17. Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said in his heart, "Shall a child be born to a man who is 100 years old?" Abraham's 100 years old, and he's going to have a son. Okay? "And shall Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child?" Now, we often think that the miracle occurred because God told Sarah and Abraham that they were going to have a child in old age. And that is correct. It did occur. But it doesn't, you know, most women and most men go, they're fertile longer. But most women go through the change of life around between the age of 45 and 55. All right? Now, if Sarah could have given child, she could have had children at 80, it was still a miracle that she had them at 90. You follow what I'm saying? So I'm not taking anything away from the fact that there was a miracle that was performed. But you'll see later with some of the other examples that people had children when they were very old and they lived a long time. And Abraham and Sarah are one of the examples. Let's go to Genesis chapter 22. Genesis chapter 22, verse 11. This is a story about Abraham and his offering of his son Isaac. Now Isaac, Abraham's 100 years old, and they tell him, "You're going to have Isaac." So Isaac's how old at this time? Let's say anywhere from 12 to 20. Let's say 15. So Abraham's 115 years old when this occurs. Okay? 115 years old. Read the account. He goes 3 days' journey and climbs a mountain. How many 115-year-old men do you know that can do that? Most of them that I know can't get up to go to the kitchen. And then he ties up his son. He's getting ready to sacrifice his son. And the angel says, no, don't do that. God, through an angel, says, don't do that. There's a ram over there. You know what he does? He goes up there and he manhandles the ram. And he ties up the ram. And he says to Isaac, "We're going to offer up the ram instead of you." Abraham was 115, maybe 120 years old when this happened. Now notice, go forward to Genesis chapter 25. Verse 1, Sarah dies. Abraham's about 145 years old in Genesis chapter 25, verse 1. And Abraham takes a wife, Keturah. And you know what Abraham does? Keturah has children. He's 145 years old and he's siring children. You sometimes skim right over that, but that's the biblical record says that. It shows that very, very plainly. Notice, verse 7. This is the sum of Abraham's life which he lived. He lived 175 years. This is after the flood, after all the changes that took place that caused his longevity to decline. Abraham was still living almost 200 years. All right, now let's look at the life of Sarah. Let's look at Genesis chapter 12. Genesis chapter 12, verse 14. Abraham comes into Egypt. Okay, Abraham comes into Egypt. And the king sees Abraham, and he sees Sarah. Sarah's a good-looking woman. And the king says, I'm going to send for that woman and put her in my harem. And Abraham says, tell him you're my sister so he doesn't kill me. They were half-brothers and half-sisters, which also has implications about fossil men that we'll talk about later on. But Sarah is taken into the harem. Sarah's 65 years old. How many 65-year-old women you want in your harem? People were aging and living longer at this time than we are now. You know that it happens again? And you know how old Sarah was then? She was about 90. And the king sent for Sarah and put her in his harem. We tend to think that people before the flood and right after the flood aged the way we do. They did not. They did not. And I'm just giving you a few examples. Isaac got married. They brought him Rebecca. You know, they sent off, you know, to Nabal and all of this. And, you know, will you come with us? And she comes with us. And she sees she sees Isaac in the field, who is not your husband. She covers herself. And Isaac loved her. He's 40 years old. First time he's been married, and he's 40. He's maturing at a later age. He dies at 180 years of age. All the patriarchs died at a long age. And as you get closer to David, the lifespan declines. So there's a couple of things here. One is that people were living for a very, very long time. That's going to become very, very important later. If you're writing notes, put down that the people of the flood and before the flood and right after the flood lived for a long, long time. The other thing is interesting, and this is just a cultural side note, is that we need to look at where they were buried. Where they were buried. Go to Genesis chapter 19. You remember the story about Lot, Sodom and Gomorrah. Let me flee up into the mountains. Where does Lot and his two daughters go to hide and to live? They go to hide and to live in a cave. Notice Genesis chapter 19, verse 30. Then Lot went up to Zorah and dwelt in the mountains, and his two daughters. And the last part says, dwelt in a cave. So here you have a very, very influential patriarch that had dealings with the angels of God, and he lives in a cave for a while. Notice Genesis 23, verse 17. This is Abraham, and Abraham is buying a burial place. Guess where he's buried? So the field of Ephron, which was in Machpelah, which was before Mamre, the field, and the cave which was in it, and all the trees were in it, he bought it. Why? As a burial place. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, don't leave me in Egypt, were all buried in caves. All of them. Do you remember the story about Jesus and his friend Lazarus dies? It's talked about in the book of John. And he goes to see him, and Martha and Mary say, oh, by now he stinks. He's been 4 days in the tomb. You know where Lazarus was buried? He was buried in a cave. Read the account. I don't have time to go there. But Lazarus was buried in a cave. The patriarchs were all buried in caves. You remember the story about Joshua, and Joshua goes and he has war, and the kings run away from him and they go hide. You know where they go hide? They go hide in a cave. And he kills them, and he throws them back in the cave, and he covers it over with rocks. You remember the story about Elijah, and Elijah is being chased by Jezebel? And Elijah goes into the wilderness to hide. He fasts for 40 days and 40 nights. You know where he lives? He lives in a cave. We all have the tendency, and we all tend to think that people that live in caves are backwards. Because scientists tell us that's where all the fossil men are being found. They're being found in caves. And if you live in a cave, you're backwards. You know that, well, I'll get to that later. I'll get that later. Let's go to Hebrews 11. Sometimes we read things and we just skim right over them. Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11. This is called the faith chapter. Which brings up the following point, brethren. You don't need faith to believe that you were created. You actually need more faith to believe in evolution than you do in creation. Do you need faith to believe that there's a Corvette engineer? No. You need faith, though, to believe that the Corvette just kind of sort of appeared and designed itself. You'd need that. Now notice Hebrews chapter 11, verse 35. And it's talking about the saints and about all the things they went through. You know, women received their dead raised to life again. Others were tortured, etc., etc. Verse 38, this is talking about the saints, very moral, intelligent people. Verse 38, of whom the world was not worthy, they wandered in deserts and mountains and dens and caves of the earth. It was a custom in Israel, and it has been a custom in Israel for thousands of years, to bury people in caves. You know why? A tree can move. A pile of rocks can be moved. A grove of trees can be flooded and torn up. But a cave will be there forever. As long as that mound's there, The table will be there. Let me read you some interesting things about that. Neanderthal men. There have been 345 up to about maybe 4 or 5 months ago when I did the research. There have been about 345 Neanderthal men who have been dug up. 183 of them have been dug out of caves. That's about 54%. In Carpathia, Croatia, 75 Neanderthals were buried in a cave. In France, 26 Neanderthals were dug up out of a cave. In Mount Carmel, Israel, 21 Neanderthals were buried in a cave. In Mount Carmel and Tubal Cave, 12 Neanderthals were unearthed. In France, 8 Neanderthals were buried in a cave. In Shandar Cave in Iraq, 7 Neanderthals were dug up. In Galilee, Israel, 7 Neanderthals were dug up out of a cave. In Mount Caesarea, Italy, 4 Neanderthals were found buried, you guessed it, in a cave. In a rock shelter in Lebanon, 3 Neanderthals were found buried in a cave. It's interesting. When they went to Gibraltar and they discovered a Neanderthal man in there, and they dug him out of a cave, you know that there was people living in the cave? How fair is it to say that the Neanderthals were backwards because they were living in caves when you have present-day Homo sapiens who are as modern as you and I are living in caves to this day? Where are they looking for Osama bin Laden? In a cave. Caves have always been used for thousands of years and still are being used as places of abode. And they have been used and are being used and will be used as places to bury the dead. And if you're burying somebody in a cave, that smacks of rather high intelligence and morals, does it not? You have to believe that there's an afterlife. They've been buried with tools and jewelry and all kinds of implements of war. These were not backwards people that they were digging up out of caves. You remember I talked to you about interpretation? Interpretation is very, very important. If you believe that we have descended from the apes and that we're getting more intelligent and better refined as time goes on and more culturally evolved as time goes on, and you think that people that lived before us were not as culturally evolved, you're going to believe that people that lived in caves are going to look like these types of individuals that are right here on the left-hand side. And in reality, they were very modern. They were very modern. I'll get to some of that later on. Now, let's go to Genesis chapter 6, and let's look at some things. And then we're going to talk a little bit about the fossils. But I have to lay the groundwork for you to understand what is happening. Genesis chapter 6. Genesis chapter 6, verse 1. It came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God, which were not angels, but they were simply the line of Cain, because angels don't have sex, that the sons of God, Adam is called the son of God, sons of God saw the daughters of men, the daughters of Adam's descendants, because Cain was told not to have anything to do with those people. And here you have them intermarrying. And it was not a racial problem, it was a theological problem. Because these people that were living Cain's lifestyle were degenerate. And you can see that in the fossil record. They took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. In other words, they married whoever they wanted. They didn't care what God said. You stay away from them. No, I'm going to marry whoever I want. I'll be a rebel. And the Lord said, my spirit shall not always strive with man and angels. No, with man. Forever. For he indeed is flesh, yet his day shall be 120 years. In other words, in 120 years I'm sending the flood. There were giants, or Nephilim, in the earth on those days. And also afterwards, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. These were mighty men of old, men of renown. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only on evil continually. And God said he was sorry he had made man, and he was going to do what? He was going to send the flood. And when he sent the flood, what happened? Verse 8, Noah found grace in the eyes of God. Verse 9, Noah was good. Verse 10, had three sons. Verse 12, the earth was filled, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. The earth was extremely corrupt. People were living a corrupt lifestyle. And God said, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them. And behold, I am going to destroy them with the earth. The earth was destroyed by the flood. The earth that we're living in now, the earth that we're living in now is not the same earth that existed before the flood. The earth before the flood allowed people to live 900 years. It allowed people to mature and live longer and marry and have children at a later time. It allowed people to live in better health. They were very mighty. They became men of renown, very, very strong people. These are where the legends and the stories about Hercules and Achilles and all of these Greek heroes and gods came from. If you know your mythology, what was the common factor about these people? Two things. One is they were human. They had the same passions as you and I have. The other is that they could die. And the other was that they were the son of a god. Now, you remember the story about Cain. And Cain kills his brother because Cain was jealous of his brother. And there was going to be a Savior sent. And Cain believed that he was a Savior. Cain believed that he was God. And Cain believed that he was God, so he called himself a son of God. Not in a symbolic way, but he believed that, yeah, I am God. I am the Son of the Most High. I am the promised Messiah. You're going to build a religion around me. We still have it. Some people are going to be celebrating in a few days. That religion is still with us. It hasn't gone anywhere. So you now have Cain, who is the son of God, intermarrying with the righteous line of Seth and engendering a line of people that were rebellious, powerful, and mighty, and they did not follow God's way of life. And this is talked about here in Genesis chapter 6. And God says because of this and other things, He was going to destroy the earth because the earth had corrupted itself during this time. Now, I want you to think about some things. From a scientific point of view, right here I have some fossil amber. It predates the flood. Now they say it's millions of years old. It's not that old. But it predates the flood. Now everybody remember Jurassic Park, right? Remember Jurassic Park? They took the amber and they took the needle and they drilled in there and they got the dino blood out of the mosquito and they cloned the dinosaur, right? Forget that part. What scientists have actually done is they've taken amber and there's little bubbles in there of air. And the air bubbles, well, let's analyze them. So they drill into the amber and they discover that the amber has 50% more oxygen. We have 21% oxygen in our atmosphere now. The amber has 35% oxygen. So it's got 50% more oxygen. Now, if you've done if you follow football, you'll know that they play football players a lot of money to play football. It amounts to thousands of dollars per second. So they want to keep these people healthy. They have in every training camp what's called a hyperbaric chamber. Hyperbaric chamber, there's a picture of them right down there. Hyperbaric chamber is used to treat diabetes. It's used to treat all kinds of physical problems. And basically what it is, it's a chamber they put you in. They double the air pressure, and they fill it with 100% oxygen. And divers who were put in these to decompress after they came off of dives back in the 80s, they discovered that if some of them had cuts, cuts in their hands, that they would heal up in a few hours. Now, let me ask you a question. If you lived in a world that had double the air pressure and maybe, say, 60% oxygen or 50% more oxygen, you see the implications for longevity? You see how people could live a long, long time? Let's say that, the Bible says that there was no rain, and I'm just giving you a few tidbits here to think about. So to kind of get your some of this is speculative, but some of it I'm sure is absolutely correct. If you take, for example, you read the Genesis record, and it says that there was no rain, and that there was no rainbow, and that the rainbow came after the flood because rain was a new thing. If there's no rain, that means that the hydrologic system is different. And that implies mountain building and all that. We're not going to go there. There was mountains that were built during the flood. But there was no rain before the flood. If there's no rain before the flood, which the biblical record talks about, that means that all the trace elements that are in the ground would not be washed into the ocean. They're being washed into the ocean now. You know what we do now? We pay a lot of money for drugs, for supplements, for nutritional supplements to do what? This has got this trace metal in it. This has got this trace mineral in it. This has got this trace salt in it. If you were living in a world that didn't get rained on, those trace elements would be in the ground, and when plants sprouted and lived, they would take those elements up into their seeds, into the fibers, and you would eat them. How about the genetics? You know that Abraham, he really was his wife's half brother. They had the same, different father, same mother, but different father, or vice versa. I'm not sure which one it is, but they had one parent that was the same. It was okay for Abraham and Sarah to marry each other. Where did Adam get his wife? Excuse me, where did Cain and Abel get their wives? They got it from their sisters. Why? Because there was no genetic problem. The genetic material was perfect at the time. You were closer to the original. Where did Eve come from? Eve was a clone. And cloning is really big now. Eve was a clone of Adam. She was taken from Adam. And Adam has an X and a Y chromosome. And a woman has an X and an X. You know, you've got the story about the king, and the king's going around saying, give me a daughter, or give me a son to the queen. It's not the queen's fault, it's the king's. The king's supplying the X and the X and the X and the Y. All the woman supplies is the X and the X. It's interesting that woman has X and X, and man has X and Y. So woman came out of man scientifically. In other words, there's scientific evidence to support the fact that woman is a clone of man. But my point is this. Adam and Eve was a clone of Adam, and they engendered children, and there was no problem. As you get further down the biblical record and you go to the times of the house of Israel, there were certain rules and laws made up about you couldn't marry your aunt, you couldn't marry your cousin, and those type of things. And as we're getting further and further down, there's all kinds of recessive genes that we're carrying, and these genes, when you intermarry with somebody else, there can be problems. Because by themselves they're not a problem, but if the gene problem is here and the other gene problem is here and you put them together, then you have a problem. And so what I'm getting at is that the genetic material was a lot better before the flood and right after the flood. So there's all kinds of longevity things that go into effect here. The world we're living in now is not the same as the world before. This had a lot of ramifications for early man. Early man, I covered some of this last time, but let me go into details with some of this now. Now, I want you to consider some things. You have here a skull of Homo neanderthalensis, Neanderthal man. And here you have a modern skull of Homo sapien. And there's some subtle differences between them. One is that Homo neanderthalensis has a bigger brain case. It's pointed in the back. And he's got eyebrow ridges. And Homo sapien has a higher dome here. No eyebrow ridges. And he looks more like that. Excuse me, I'm not an artist. But this is Neanderthal man. Now I want you to consider something. When the flood came, the flood brought the ice ages. You can read about the ice ages coming in the book of Job, when it talks about the frost coming from the north and all those things. The ice ages came. Do you know that if you take people and it's very cold, they're going to put on heavy clothing and they're going to live inside. And when they live inside, they're not going to get sunlight. And when they don't get sunlight, they don't manufacture vitamin D. Vitamin D, or a lack of vitamin D, causes rickets. Some of you who are older remember the old cod liver oil. You took cod liver oil when you were a kid. Some of you still may take it, or fish oil pills. And the reason is that cod liver oil provides vitamin D. And vitamin D keeps you from getting rickets. And rickets, what rickets are they're softening of the bones. And when the bones get soft, then you provide yourself with enough vitamin D, the bones harden up. But the problem becomes if you're a child and you have rickets and for example, your legs bow, and then you begin to eat enough vitamin D, they harden up in a bent state. That's rickets. It's very uncommon now because we have good health and our bread and our milk is fortified with vitamin D. It's almost non-existent. If you read the journal articles, they will tell you that all the Neanderthal skulls, all of them have evidence of rickets, which means that the bones were soft. Now, let me read you some quotes about Neanderthal man. Okay? It says, the morphology of Neanderthal man. I want you to remember that Neanderthal men have been found buried in caves along with Homo sapiens, which, in other words, we have these two classes of skulls found buried together. Okay? It says, because of the richness of the Neanderthal record, we do have a general idea of what they look like. There is a distinct Neanderthal morphology. Number one, large cranial capacity, the average being larger than the average for modern humans. Neanderthal man had more brains than modern men. Skull shape, low, broad, and elongated. Low, broad, and elongated. And you can see that in the cast that I have there. Rear of skull, rather pointed, with an occipital bun. Large, heavy brow ridges. Low forehead, not as domed as our forehead. Large, long faces with center face jutting forward. Weak, rounded chin. Postcranial, below the neck. Postcranial skeleton, rugged, with bones very thick. Below the skull, they were extremely strong. They have more brains than you have, and they have a stronger skeleton than you have. They predate us. Doesn't seem like evolution is working very well there, does it? Let me read you some more. One of the most characteristic features of the Neanderthals is the exaggerated massiveness of their trunk and limb bones. All of the preserved bones suggest a strength. The Bible called them men of renown. Suggest a strength seldom attained by modern humans. Furthermore, not only is there robustness present among the adult males, as one might expect, but also evident in the adult females, adolescents, and children. Neanderthals were far more powerful than modern humans. This is Geist, who was an evolutionist. Whereas archaeologists can experimentally duplicate the wear patterns on tools such as were used by people from the Upper Paleolithic, the people that followed Neanderthal, the wear patterns on Neanderthals' tools cannot be duplicated. We do not have the strength to do it. Neanderthal skeletons reflect a supremely powerful musculature. Neanderthal people were built. The children were built. The women were built. You know, it's interesting. If you look at the journal articles that I have here, when you mature at a later age, you know what happens to your skeleton? Your skeleton mass increases. You know that if you are subjected to cosmic rays from outer space or to radiation, you know that your puberty level or the age of puberty goes down. In other words, they've done statistical studies of people, for example, who have leukemia, children, and they irradiate them to fight the disease. And they find that statistically women, men, children, young ladies and young men who are given massive doses of radiation, that they go to puberty at an earlier age. If there was a shield that covered the Earth's surface, and this shield, whatever it was, and I have my theories about it, is no longer there, more cosmic rays would be coming down to the Earth. And if more cosmic rays were coming down to the Earth, people would go through puberty at a younger age, which means they would be able to have children sooner. And it also means that they would be dying off sooner, because the cosmic rays would affect your longevity. You follow what I'm saying? The longevity is tied in to the environment they were living in. The rickets were tied in to their diet and the sunlight. Okay? The evidence indicates, this is bones of contention, the evidence indicates that Neanderthals were people of incredible power and strength, far superior to all but the most avid bodybuilders of today. And it talks more about some other Neanderthal people, but they were extremely powerful and extremely strong. Now, here's a couple of things to think about. If the people of the book of Genesis were living to 800-900 years in relatively good health, obviously they died after 800-900 years. Enoch was considered a young man at 360 years of death. But they were living a long time. They were living in relatively good health. They had good genetics, but they were suffering from rickets, because they would go into the mountains because it was now cold. What would happen is the bones would become very soft. And when the bones became soft, the powerful facial muscles would begin to distort the cranium. And what you would have is you would have this right here being built up to keep the eye sockets from collapsing from all of the powerful muscles that were on their face. You know what happens to a skull of a person? If you're 80 years old, and you're alive today, and you could take your skull and you could compare it to the skull you had when you were 20, you would find that your skull has flattened, it has gotten pointed at the back, and it has gotten rounder, which means that your army hat won't fit anymore. That's why your army hat won't fit even though you haven't gained any weight. Because your skull changes with age. So if people were living for 800-900 years, think of the massive skull changes that would be taking place. Some people who didn't suffer from rickets would not have soft bones. So they would have the morphology of modern man. That's why you're finding, and people often wonder, how can they find Neanderthal man and how can they find modern man in the same strata, in the same cave? And the reason is because some had a diet that was adequate in vitamin D and some didn't. I'm not going to get into syphilis. Syphilis, which is a degenerative disease, causes bone malformations. All of us are familiar with arthritis, what it does to your bones. What if you lived to be 600 years and you had arthritis? Now, I also have journal articles over there that show that Homo erectus people were suffering from what is called vitaminosis A. What is vitaminosis A? Vitaminosis A is when you eat too much vitamin A. Question becomes, where does vitamin A come from? Well, the scientists have done research, and what they've discovered is vitamin A comes from carnivore livers, wolf liver, jackal liver, lion liver, bear liver. Are those clean or unclean? All unclean. If people were going around eating the unclean livers of carnivores, and let's say that they were doing it not for 30 or 40 years, but let's say they were doing it for 400 or 500 years, you would end up having your skull and your skeleton degenerate. And that would cause all kinds of problems. But the Bible says that the world had corrupted itself. You know, you've all heard of Java Man and Peking Man. Well, they find the top of the skulls, and they find the top of the skulls, and you know what they discovered? They find out that somebody during this time was going around killing people, knocking the tops of their heads off, and snacking on human brains. You're living for 400 or 500 years. You're eating human brains, which contain all kinds of endocrine chemicals in them, which affect how you grow, how you develop. Think about the consequences for your skeleton and for your skull. So there's very good scientific evidence that shows that the biblical record is correct. Now, some of this is speculation because the Bible is not explicit on it. But people will tell you, no, look, the Neanderthal man looks this way because of evolution. He's closer to the apes. That's interpretation. This doesn't come labeled when you dig him up with, I have descended from the apes. That's an interpretation that the person who digs him up places on it. I've just shown you that you can take the same fossils, the same skulls, and you can dig them up, and you can show that they fit the biblical record. Do you know that most of the Neanderthal and the Homo sapiens skeletons that they're digging up from this time period suffer from a lot of broken bones? You know, the bones have been broken, and they've healed up. They've got gashes to the side of the head where they've healed up. What does the Bible say about this time? It was a very wicked time, and men were very corrupt. And they were going around fighting and beating each other up. The fossils support the biblical account. Now, let me give you some other things to think about. Let's take, for example, the bias in the fossils. This right here is a fossil. And right here, we have a picture of what the scientists believe that the fossil looked like when they reconstruct it. Now, this is, they only find pieces of it. And these pieces are crumpled up and laying on the ground, and they have to reconstruct it, and they have to put them together. If you look at these, it's made up of thousands of little pieces. And they reconstructed them. And you'll notice that most apes and monkeys have a slanted face. Their face juts forward like this. This skull has been given an apish slant. You see it? Okay, and if you look at the skull itself, this is a cast. The black stuff is material they used to fill it in because they haven't found bones. And you'll look and you'll notice that it's hinged right here. It kind of free floats. So it would have been very easy for the person who put this together to have given it a less apish cast. You follow what I'm saying? In other words, this slant here is interpretation. And you can see that right here where they didn't completely push the skull back in. You can see where the material is missing, and they could have very easily pushed it back in. But they subjectively knowing that evolution is correct and this is closer to the Australopithecus africanus, which were very ape-like, therefore we're going to give it an apish cast. This fossil can be reconstructed to be perfectly human. They give it an apish nose. Nose is made out of cartilage. Nose doesn't fossilize. The kind of nose you give it is all in your interpretation. So if you'd have taken this woman, and I'd like you to come up and look at this after we finish, and she looks pretty human now, but if you'd have taken this woman and given her a less slanted face and given her a human nose, she would look completely human. She could probably be sitting in here and nobody would even know. The problem is that this fossil, it's a very famous fossil, KNMR ER 1470, was found in strata that was 2.8 million years old. Now, you remember back here, we talked about the age of some of these characters here, and we talked about Australopithecus being about 4 to 1.5 million years old. This is a Homo erectus skull, and it's supposed to be about 2 million to 1 million years old. This has been dated at about 3 million years, 2.8, 2.9. I have the journal articles there written in the 1970s. And then you know what they discovered? They discovered that, oh, this is way too old to be too modern. So what did they do? They redated the strata, and they came up with 1.8. And then the other persons redated the strata and said, no, no, you're wrong. It's really 2.9. And then they redated the strata again and said, no, no, you're wrong. It's 1.6. And then they redated the strata again and said, no, no, you're wrong. It's 2.9. And then they redated, and they went back and forth. And the whole scientific community was watching this. When National Geographic tells you that this skull is 1.8 million years old, they don't tell you that there was a big controversy that says it could have been twice that age. Which means that if you take this human-looking skull and you give it an age of about 3 million years old, evolution is not correct. That's just this one fossil. They've manipulated what it looks like. They've manipulated the nose they gave it. They've manipulated the volume of the crania. And they've manipulated the date it was found at. All of those are not scientific data. All of those are subjective data dependent on the interpretation and the prejudice of the person finding the skull. That's what I'm getting at. There's a lot of bias in fossils. Over here, there's a picture of a KP271 fossil of a lower elbow, upper arm, lower elbow bone. This is the bone right here. It goes right here. They found the bottom of this. I'd like to read you some of the things they say about this fossil. And these are going to be the evolutionist's words, not my words. These are directly out of the journal articles written in Nature and in Science. And please feel free to come up and look at these and open these up and look at them. And all of this literature that I'm reading to you is in that CD that I'm going to be leaving with Mr. Myers. All right. They analyzed this fossil with a computer. All right. And they discovered that the results show that the Canopy specimen, which is 4 to 4.5 million years old, is indistinguishable from modern Homo sapiens. In other words, you have a fossil of a modern human that's 4.5 million years old. So modern man's only supposed to have been around for about 500,000 years, and you have a modern fossil that the scientists accept as modern, some of them don't, as 4.5 million years old. You got the grandma principle kicking in there. That these guys here, Australopithecus afarensis, cannot be the ancestor of something that existed before it did. They have discovered footprints in volcanic ash. Let me read you what they discovered about them. And these are just a few of the examples. I don't have time to give you all these examples. Okay, here we go. Modern footprints, 3.6 million years old. Footprints that are remarkably similar to those of modern man. Notice what it says here. This is Lucy, The Beginnings of Humankind, a book I have right over there. This is one of the discoverers of Lucy. He was Mr. White. And notice what he says, Tim White. And he's talking about these fossil footprints they found that are about 3.8 to 4 million years old. Make no mistake about it, says Tim. They are like modern human footprints. If one were left in the sand of a California beach today and a four-year-old were asked what it was, he would instantly say that somebody had walked there. He wouldn't be able to tell it from 100 other prints on the beach, nor would you. The external morphology, or shape, is the same. There is a well-shaped modern heel with a strong arch and a good ball of foot in front of it. The big toe is straight in line. It doesn't stick out of the side like the ape toe or like the big toe of so many drawings you see of Australopithecus in books. He's saying that a four-year-old would see that footprint and say, hey, that's a man's footprint. The question now becomes, why don't they? They're too old to be modern. If the footprints are actually, in reality, 4 million years old, then they predate their ancestors. And therefore, they cannot be correct. And you know what they do? Instead of saying, we've made a mistake with a theory, what they do is they show ape men with human feet. Because obviously you had human feet back there, and so they with prejudice draw the feet with an ape body, and they have human feet on it. And these are just a few of the examples. There are literally many, many examples, and that's what I'm saying. You don't have to go to the creationist literature to find these. All of these examples I've given you are coming out of the evolutionary literature, and it's very interesting when you examine that. And some of the other things are, we talked here about the fossils, and you have Australopithecus about 4 million years ago. You have Homo erectus about 2 million to 1 million years ago. You got Homo Neanderthalensis and Homo sapiens about 500,000 years ago. When you take the fossils and you actually look at them, let's look at our handout that we have here. Everybody has a handout? If you need a handout, just raise your hand and we'll get you one. You might want to look on with somebody. If you look on the very last page of the handout, you will see on the left-hand side the picture out of an evolutionary book of the fossil tree. And you see that Afarensis is first, and then Homo erectus is next at about 1 million years, and then Homo sapiens are next. This is the way it's portrayed in evolutionary books. If you take the actual fossils, like I have, and you go to the actual journal articles that were written by evolutionists, and you look at the dates that they assign to the fossils that they find, in other words, these are not my dates. These are the evolutionary anthropologist's dates. And you put them in order, you get the chart on the right. And the chart on the right shows that Homo erectus has existed up until about 6,000 years ago. And it shows that Homo sapiens have existed for about 4.5 million years. And there's fossils all in between those. In other words, what I'm getting at is that the pictures that you see in National Geographic and the pictures that you see on Discovery Channel and the pictures that you see in the textbooks that you have at school, they're giving you a false, incomplete picture. The fossil record truly is the record on the right-hand side. And up here, I've got that chart with the fossils listed, showing the name of the fossil and how old it is and where it is in the journal articles. You can actually see that it's not Arnold Mendez saying that this fossil is, 3 million years old. It's the evolutionist saying it. And that's what I'm getting at. Science is prostituted for evolution. When you take the scientific journal articles and you just take their dates without interpretations and you put them on a chart, you will come up with this chart right here. And it's very similar to the one I've drawn you here on the right. And what it shows that the fossil record shows that men, modern humans, predate their supposed ancestors. So we don't have to worry about all of these other people here. If modern man existed before they did, Australopithecus afarensis and flat-faced man from Kenya that the Leakeys had just discovered are not our ancestors, because man was around before them. What does the fossil record show? It shows that man has existed for a long, long time. It shows that men have existed without changing much for a long, long time. And it shows that there is variation in man that could account for the differences that evolutionists use as proof of evolution. Let me give you an example. Right here, I have cats. Felis domesticus. That means domesticated cat. Fancy word. Okay? There's two cat skulls. I actually harvested these and prepared them. And you look at them, they're almost identical. They are very, very similar. And I'm going to have these up here, and you can come look at them. And they're identical, even though they were different sizes. Which means that some species are very, very similar to each other. In other words, all squirrels look like each other. All cats look like each other. Even though they're the same species. On the other hand, here I have a fox terrier. Canis familiaris. Familiar dogs, what it means. And here I have a Rottweiler. And you look at the skull, you'll see that they're very, very different. But they could interbreed with each other. What I'm getting at, we tend to think of man as being like cats, that they should all have the same skulls. And in reality, men are like Canis familiaris. In other words, there's a lot of variety built into man. If you take the African pygmies, and you take a modern North American person, the modern pygmy has a cranial capacity of about 700 to 600 cc's, which is the same cranial capacity as Homo erectus. And modern man has a cranial capacity of about 12 to 1400 cc's. A lot of difference. Their skull looks different. If you found those skulls today, you would think they were different species. But yet they can interbreed among themselves. There's journal articles there that show that many people believe that if Homo erectus could be resurrected, or you could go back in a time machine and bring one forward, that a Homo erectus woman and a Homo sapien man could interbreed among themselves, which means what? Those are scientists saying that, which means they're the same kind. All I'm telling you is this, that the fossil record shows that the human line has great variety. Some of it is genetic. Some of it is caused by things we do after we're born. For example, rickets and syphilis and overabundance of vitamin A and all of those things. We're not sure exactly what is what, and because bones don't talk. But we do understand that those things happen. Now, when I finish, I'd like y'all to come up here and look at the journal articles that I have up here. They're very, very interesting. You'll be able to see the dating battle that went on back and forth. And these dating battles are going on between the evolutionists among themselves. It's very funny that evolutionists will have big discussions among themselves about I disagree with this and I disagree with that. But if you're a creationist and you tell them, well, this is what I think, they won't even listen to you. Evolution and paleoanthropology is the only branch of science that people outside of the branch are not allowed to interpret into it. If a mathematician says 2 plus 2 is 5, and you can show them that 2 plus 2 is not 5, but it's actually 4, they'll listen to you. In evolution, that is not true. Evolutionary scientists will not do that. So, what I've done is several things. I've shown you that the fossils have been interpreted incorrectly. And the reason they've been interpreted incorrectly is because there's a lot of bias in the fossil record, in the fossil interpretation of the record, because the people doing the interpreting are biased. I've shown you that the fossil relationships are incorrect. Australopithecus afarensis, this gentleman here, is simply an extinct ape. If you go to Zaire, which is a few hundred miles from where they're digging up Australopithecus afarensis and Africanus, you find Pan Paniscus, which is a pygmy chimp. And if you take the skeleton of a Pan Paniscus and of an Australopithecus and you set them side by side, they're almost identical. In other words, Australopithecus afarensis is alive today. So how can he be the pre-ancestor? In other words, these humans and these animals that they're digging up saying are that they are the descendants of humans are actually kinds that have not, they haven't changed in a long periods of time. Now, I'm not going to get into the dating system. Maybe we can get into that in the question and answers. But the dating system is not correct. But you don't have to worry about the dating system. You don't have to worry about whether your grandma is 60 years old or 90 years old. If your grandma was born after you, she's not your grandma. That's what I'm getting at. Independent of what dates you assign them. That's why I'm being very fluid with my dates. It doesn't matter. Whatever dates you give them. Because the dates that, relationships you give them, the dates don't matter. If Homo sapiens and Homo erectus and Homo neanderthalensis preceded their ancestors, not their ancestor. They're not, and that's what I've tried to show you. That's what I've tried to show you today in the fossil record. Now, I've showed you that the evolutionary record has been interpreted incorrectly. It is not correct. Scientifically, it's biased. I've also showed you that Australopithecus afarensis is merely an extinct ape, and that Homo sapiens, Homo neanderthalensis, and Homo erectus were all descendants of Adam, who either had degenerated, were of the line of Cain, were extremely powerful and were men of renown, or who were simply modern humans who did not suffer from rickets and who were extremely powerful and lived at the same time. They're all descendants of Adam. Just as surely as we and the Pygmies and the Bushmen and the people that live in Norway and all that variety that exists today, we're all brothers and sisters. We all descended from the same common stock. And I've showed you also that the fossil record supports the book of Genesis. Men were very violent. The world was corrupt. The men were very powerful. And there was no such thing as pre-Adamic men. And I've showed you also that we are, by implications, a product of divine creation. If the fossil record is not correct, then God created us, basically. And the main thing I wanted you to see today is, and even though I have, you know, I've been very general, because you have to be in this area, I've been very general and sort of speculative, I've tried to get you to see that you don't have to have faith. You know, I believe that God created us, and I believe it just because I have faith. You can use scientific evidence to bolster the fact that we are created. Now, I won't fill in all, you know, we can't fill in all the details because not even the evolutionists know all the details. But we can make certain basic assumptions and generalities. And that is that the fossil record, as it is written and as the bones reveal, do agree overall with the book of Genesis. All right, we're going to have about a 5-minute break, and then I will call you back in and we will have questions and answers. Okay, could you please make your way down to sit down, please? You don't have to stay for the question and answers. If you don't want to ask any or listen, you go ahead and leave or else move up to the front, please. All right, now, in a minute, I'm going to take some question and answers. But before I do, I know this is being videotaped and probably audio taped, so I'm going to repeat the question that you asked me to make sure that it's the question you indeed asked and that I answer it correctly. If it is not the question you ask, when I repeat it, then let me know and I'll reformulate the question so that it will appear on the videotape. Also, for the sake of those listening by videotape, my email address is acm@arnoldmendez.com, and you can reach me there. Also, we have some brochures here. If you're visiting from another church area, if you'd like me to present the seminar in your area, just pick up a brochure and give it to your minister or your activity coordinator and have him contact me. And I will be happy to arrange to do one in your area. So after we have the question and answer period, then I'm going to go, I think they're going to have a meeting in here afterwards. So I'm going to, after a few minutes, tear down the displays here. And I'll be outside talking to any of those who would like to continue the conversation. So at this time, I will go ahead and take questions from the floor. Anybody have any questions? Yes, sir. Okay, he asked, what is the problem with the dating system? How do the dating systems come up with millions of years when obviously they're in conflict with the Bible? Okay, and also he asked specifically about carbon dating. I'm not going to go through the whole carbon dating scenario with you, but carbon dates are good for about 30 to 40,000 years, and after that you have potassium-argon dating that is used, and then after that you have lead to uranium-238 dating that is used. Now, the problem with the dating system is basically that it is based on certain assumptions. And I'm going to talk mainly about the argon-potassium dating system for about a minute to give you some of the assumptions and then show you how they're wrong and what the problem with it is. There's a couple of things you have to remember. One is that man has only been around for approximately 6,000 to 7,000 years. Therefore, when people say, okay, we found this Homo neanderthalensis skull, and it's 34,000 years old, what is the problem? One thing you have to consider is most of those skulls are dated using carbon dating, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that, and that is that the carbon dates are incorrect because the environment that existed before the flood changed the assumptions that go into carbon dating. One is it changed the formation of the carbon dates, the rates that they were formed. And that has to do with nitrogen-14 getting bombarded by a cosmic ray and producing carbon-14, the change in the atomic structure. And if there's more carbon or less carbon, it's going to affect the ratios of the 14 to the regular carbon-12, which is how the dates are run. So if the ratio of carbon is different, the dates will be different. If there's less radiation or more radiation coming in, the formation of the carbon-14 will be different. Also, if there's more nitrogen in the atmosphere, which is what actually gets bombarded by the cosmic ray, the nitrogen, there's going to be more or less of it. It's going to affect how much carbon-14 is produced. So you have ratios, and what I'm getting at is the ratio of the carbon-14 to the carbon-12 is what gives you the date. And if those ratios are wrong, then the date will be wrong. It's very interesting that the dates for carbon-14 pretty much agree up until the flood. About 4,000 years ago, 4,500 years ago. After that, they become very stretched out. I believe that environmentally and atmospherically, there was some problems, or not problems, but there was a different atmosphere before the flood, and this difference in the atmosphere caused the cosmic rays to do their job better or worse, depending on which scenario you use. The volcanoes had more carbon, put more carbon monoxide into the atmosphere, which then gets broken down and becomes carbon dioxide. The carbon dioxide gets put into our bodies through the foods we eat, and that affects the ratio. So what I'm getting at is before the flood, there were differences that caused the carbon-14 production rates to be different, which would give you different dates. The argon dates are based on heat, volcanic heat, magma, driving out an isotope of potassium. And then the potassium decays into argon. Okay? And what happens then is they date how much argon is there, and they know how much or how old it is by the decay rate of the argon and the potassium. The problem is that they make assumptions about how effective all the argon is driven out of the magma. For example, to be general, if you take lava and you date it through potassium argon dating, it should show a date of 0 years if the volcano erupted yesterday. And in a million years, there should be enough of this isotope that you show a date of a million years. Well, what they're actually finding is that when they look at the volcanoes, for example, in Hawaii that have erupted 4 or 5 years ago, they look at those dates that potassium argon is giving, and they're dates of like 2.8 million years old. You know, 200 million years old. Things like that. So some contemporary volcanoes are being dated, and you come up with extremely old ages. So that shows me that the dating system is not correct. And I don't want to get into the specifics. But the problem with the dating system is that they're based on assumptions that people think are unchangeable. And what we're finding out is that the dating systems are based on assumptions that are changeable. And the changes in these assumptions causes you to get different dates than what you should get. And that's basically the way that lines out. If you want to, I can outside draw you a big technical diagram of the atomic structure of the carbon and the nitrogen and what particles give off and all of this type of thing, and we can do that outside. But for the sake of putting everybody to sleep, we won't do that. But the assumptions are not correct. Yes, ma'am. Okay, she's asking if there's a way to look at the pH balance of the fossils and to see whether they were in an environment that was acidic or basic. Whether they would be more acid or alkaline. There probably is a way to do that. The question would be, why would you want to do it? Because it would have... Okay, so alkaline people live longer is what you're getting at. Okay, she's saying that alkaline people that have an alkaline system live longer than people who have a basic system. And therefore, if we could look at the acidity or basicity of these organisms, we could figure out whether they live longer or not. And as far as I know, there hasn't been any studies done on that. There may have been, but I haven't run across any. Usually it's the longevity studies are done on the wear patterns of the teeth and the... A lot of your fossils have sutures, and the sutures are closed up. And as a person lives longer, an 80-year-old, sutures will be closed up. And a young person, the sutures will be very open right here. And a lot of your fossils have suture closures that show that they, if you interpret it from a longevity point of view, that they have lived a long time. But as far as it's usually done by the morphology and not by the acidity and the basicity, I think probably you would have a problem with it having long time ago the acidity or the basicity being neutralized probably and no longer in the fossil. Because what they find is when they find the fossils, they usually find it's a rock, so it's changed chemically and it's not what it used to be before. So the basicity and the acidity would not be a factor anymore. Another question over here? Okay, what would I say briefly about what the world was like during the time of Adam and Eve and what it was like before the time of Genesis 1-2? Before Adam and Eve. The world during Adam and Eve was a perfect world. It's coming back. It's called a millennium. Animals were very docile. They lived a long time. I gave an example of somebody who talked to me just a few minutes ago. They had a Welsh elk that was about 900 pounds, had an antler spread of about 14 feet. You had woolly mammoths that were very large. You had reptiles that were extremely large. We call them dinosaurs now. And they lived, all these indications are that animals lived for a long time. They had larger body masses. The dinosaurs had very small nostrils, large body masses. They could not exist in the atmospheric pressure and the oxygen content that we have now. They needed that oxygen-rich and more pressurized atmosphere that probably existed during their time. We had dragonflies that existed during the Mesozoic that were 40 dragonflies that were 42 inches in wingspan, and dragonflies assimilate oxygen through osmotic pressure, and the only way they could survive is if there was more pressure and more oxygen. So some of the things that occurred is animals became larger and took on gigantic proportions, and that was a result of some of these things we're talking about. Very complex, long subject. I'll talk to you about it outside, but the world we're living in now could not produce and support the organisms that lived in the world before. And the reason is because we're living in a different world. I believe that world, parts of it, will be reinstituted during the millennium. Let me give you something to think about. God said, the day that you eat of that, you're going to die. In reality, the Hebrew says, in the day that you eat of it, dying you shall die. It says that with God, 1,000 years is like a day. Noah, all these patriarchs, Adam, lived 930, Methuselah, 969 years, all short of 1,000-year day. In the millennium, just something to think about. In the millennium, if you're born into the millennium, at 200 years into the millennium, because people are going to have babies, is that child going to die at 70 years? Or is he going to live on through the millennium? Next question. Yes, sir. Uh huh. Right. He asked about what is my opinion about the distinction between the sons of God and the men of renown, the Nephilim, that were talked about in Genesis chapter 6. I believe that the Neanderthal men were the Nephilim, because that's my opinion. There's some evidence to indicate that, because they were extremely powerful, extremely strong. I believe that the men of renown were another class of humans, and they're all humans. They could intermate, they could interbreed among themselves. And there was a lot of blending of the two. And sometimes the Neanderthals and the Homo sapiens were buried in the same cave systems, which means they had the same culture and the same family structure. And if you had a Neanderthal man in here, he would be extremely well proportioned and could sit right among us and would hardly go, would be unnoticed. So the differences have been accentuated by evolutionists in order to prove that there has been a descent of man. But I don't think the differences are that great. But I think that the men of renown were modern Homo sapiens who looked more or less like us, but they were extremely strong. All men that lived during this time period were extremely well-built in proportion. That includes the ladies and the children. They were just extremely strong and very muscular. They have muscular markings on their scapulas and on their ribs where the muscles attach. Only occurs in about 10% of very strong men. It occurred in about 60% of all the Neanderthal and early Homo sapiens skeletons. So people were extremely built at this time. And that goes in with some of the things we talked about, and the genetic record and the diets and all the things they were talking about. So I believe that Neanderthal man was a man of the Nephilim, and I believe the men of renown were very powerful Homo sapiens. He's talking about the Anakins. The Anakins are giants. They were giants in stature. The Nephilim, the word translated giant, means a knocker down or a tumbler over of bigger people. Neanderthals were about 5'4", 5'5". So they were smaller, but they could take down a bigger individual. So it refers to them being giant indeed, not in stature. The people that the spies saw when they went into the land of Israel, those were a race of giants. And they were actually tall people. They're genetic descendants of Adam also. Another question? In the back. Okay, he asked about the transitional fossils. Since there are no transitional fossils, and evolutionists realize this, how do they explain this, since it seems to support creation and not evolution? Okay, the answer is easy. Whenever scientists come to a problem like this, they simply change up a little facet of the theory, but they cling to the theory. The way they get around this, in other words, transitional fossils, you have an organism that's here, and he's evolved. You have an organism with three of these, and he's evolved in an organism of four, of five. In between, you should have an organism of four. I'm being very simplistic here. How do they explain this? Well, they say that it took a quantum leap from three directly into five. And they explain this by what's called punctuated equilibrium, which is simply a way of saying that evolution jumps from species to species. Everybody heard of that? Punctuated? All it is a proof of evolution without fossils. Punctuated equilibrium is a theory that has no proof. And really, if you get down to brass tacks, punctuated equilibrium, if you take it to its logical conclusion, is creation. Because things are appearing rapidly. So punctuated equilibrium is simply another fancy way of saying things have appeared in the fossil record quickly. And to me, it's just easier to say creation. All right, other questions? Yes, ma'am. Okay.
It's about 200 years
left. Okay, she's asking about the difference in the chronology that the biblical people use, which is about 6,000 years, and the Jewish people use, which is about 5,700 years. Okay. And, well, all of the chronologies are based on genealogies of the who begat the whos. And the differences is in how you come to the conclusion of how old somebody was when they begat somebody else. And those are found in the books of Genesis chapter 5 and Genesis chapter 11. What's happened is the Jewish people have differences in how they interpret how old somebody was when they had a child, or they insert individuals in there who are not in there, and there, or they take away individuals who are not in there. There is some evidence to indicate that men have been around for slightly more than 6,000 years, because the genealogies seem to be, and this is very speculative, seem to be that the record has some gaps in it of a few hundred years. And so it's a possibility that in reality, man might be, have been around for maybe 6,400, 6,500 years. We're not sure. I like the theory that we've been around for about 6,000 years because it fits well with the millennium and the creation week. But right. Yes, she's talking about the difference in the 200 years. And it all comes into play with how old people are when they had their children and if there's people missing in the genealogical record. And the Jews apparently have pulled out some people that we have inserted. And it's not as clear-cut as some would indicate, but that's the basic reason. Yes, sir. Yes, if there's fossil records that Homo sapiens and dinosaurs are contemporaries, the answer is yes and no. There is no fossil evidence that Homo sapiens were contemporary with the dinosaurs that existed during the Triassic and the Jurassic period, because man was not around at that time. The problem becomes is how do you define a dinosaur? If a dinosaur is simply a large reptile, then there are some historical records, not fossil records, but there, and you're talking about probably Glen Rose, in Texas, where they found the footprints, which I believe are carvings. But the problem becomes, or the thing becomes, how you define dinosaurs. If dinosaurs are simply large reptiles and animals during the time of Adam lived to be large, then you would have animals that were small in our world being very large in the world of Adam. And I'll give you an example. A chameleon is about this long when you buy him at the pet store. You know, you say, please, Mom, let me have him. I'll take care of him. And in 20 years, he's 5 feet long. Turtles grow longer as they age. You can tell how old a crocodile is by measuring him with a tape measure. They found that 40-foot crocodile a few months back, written up in the National Geographic. Reptiles are the only animals that the longer they live, the bigger they get. If animals were living a long time, such as 14-foot turtles, which they have found in the fossil record, that seems to indicate that animals lived a long time. So if during the time of Adam, if some animals, reptiles, were living 300 or 400 years, then it's a possibility that there were some very large reptilian creatures that lived with man. And I think this is the basis for some of our legends about dragons and about things like that where men actually fought with dragons. So there's no fossil evidence, but there's historical evidence. Now, another thing is most people will never believe that the dinosaurs existed with man. So if there's ever been fossils found with them, they will misinterpret them or reinterpret them to show that they're not correct. Yes, sir. Right. He asked, if God creates everything for a purpose, what's my speculation behind the world of the dinosaurs and why God created them? I believe that God created the dinosaurs because Satan is a great serpent. He's a serpent. If you look in the books of Ezekiel and in the books of the book of Ezekiel, it talks about the four living creatures, man, ox, lion, and eagle. And they were angelic creatures, very powerful creatures that were in the shape of animals. We have been fashioned after the God kind, man has. What were the animals fashioned after? I believe they were fashioned after the angelic kind. They were modeled after the angels. And Satan, being a reptilian, and this is speculation, Satan, being a reptilian creature, would have been given a world to live in and govern that was full of creatures that looked like him, which were large reptiles. you know, Satan, the great red dragon, you know, the serpent, more subtle than any beast of the field, et cetera, et cetera. So I believe that Satan lived in a world that was very much like, full of people that are organisms that looked like him. I believe it was not created the way we think it was, or it was not the way we think it was. It became that way and was perverted by Satan. And probably you had very docile reptilian creatures that were created, and Satan imprinted his character on them and perverted them, and they became very ferocious. So if you want to know what man would look like after a few million years of being under Satan's rule, look at what the world of the dinosaurs was like. We'd be going around killing and eating each other. And that's speculation. I have time for a couple of more questions, and then after we finish, I'll be outside. Any more questions? Yes, sir. What are the reasons he's going to give for man's longevity as outlined in the book of Genesis? One is the air pressure, one is the oxygen content, one is the diet, one is the nutrition in the plant material they would eat. Another is the genetics. They were closer to the original, and as people degenerated and ate the wrong things and lived the wrong way, it affected themselves genetically, and the genetic material was perverted, and therefore people were not as genetically strong as they were near the beginning, and that causes decline. Another one was the falling of the carbon dioxide in the water canopy in the atmosphere that came with the flood, and that caused the ozone in the upper atmosphere to mix with the ozone in the lower atmosphere. Ozone in the upper atmosphere is very is a buffer, keeps cosmic rays from coming in. Cosmic rays coming in destroy genetic material. Also, the ozone, when it came down and you had the mountain building that went up with a flood, caused a turbulence effect in the atmosphere. And the ozone in the upper atmosphere was mixed into the lower atmosphere where we live. And ozone, when we breathe it, is very toxic. So I believe that the ozone is probably one of the things that caused us to decay and not live as long. Up there it's good, down here it's bad. So you had another thing was endocrine system changes. Another thing was the radiation coming from outer space. Also, the radiation coming from the ground. We're being bombarded with radiation coming from the ground. I think the radio decay process began with the curse of Adam. When Adam was cursed and he said, you're only going to live for so long, it's going to be very difficult, things are not going to produce, I think that's what began, my opinion, the radio decay process. And that was one of the things that causes us not to live as long. If you're an airline stewardess and you fly up at 30,000 feet, they won't let you fly if you're pregnant because there's more cosmic rays which cause birth defects. Pilots have greater incidence of skin cancer, all kinds of other problems. And that's all caused by being up above the atmosphere. A change in the atmosphere's composition would cause changes in the cosmic rays reaching us. Magnetic fields around the Earth would cause the cosmic rays to not be shunted, but to be come directly into the Earth. All those things were changed during the flood and during the curse time. So that's just a handful, but there's a whole slew of them. One more question. Yes, sir. Okay, he said, I've speculated much about mountain buildings, and he said, if I believe that during the times of Adam and Eve, there was no mountains. And the answer is that I believe that the mountains that existed were very low. If you read Genesis chapter 7, I won't go there, but it says that the waters came, and all the high hills under the whole earth were covered. And then it says, and then a few sentences later, or verses, it talks about the mountains being covered. The implication being that there was hills at the beginning of the flood, and there was mountains at the end of the flood. And I believe that the mountains being raised up caused the difference in the hydrologic cycle. It caused a difference in the wind systems. And you get the Coriolis effect, and you got the bands of wind coming across the earth. And these are the trade winds that Columbus and all these explorers came over in the 1400s, 1300s, and 1500s. And those trade winds cause a shifting in the moisture content, and that's what brings the rain. If the earth was covered by some kind of protective shield, and I won't get into all that, and not necessarily water and not necessarily that it fell during the flood, but it was covered by some kind of protective shield, and that shield was allowing the earth to be at a temperate climate, and that seems to be indicated by the fact that they discovered dinosaurs up in the down in the Antarctic, where it's obviously they don't exist there anymore, that what happened is that the earth being warm all over would cause there to be no wind systems. And then when you got cold at the top and cold at the bottom and hot in the middle because of the sun striking the earth, you're trying to get this and this to equalize with the middle, and you create wind systems. And those wind systems are also caused by the mountains coming up. On one side of the mountain, you've got the deserts. On the other side of the mountains, you've got Sierra Nevadas and California. It's a good example. But I believe that during the flood, because it says that all the mountains were covered, you don't need to cover Mount Everest. Mount Everest was a product of the flood. You know, you don't need 35,000 feet of water. You could cover the earth with a few gallons of water if it was completely flat, theoretically speaking. So if the earth was flatter, you wouldn't need as much water. I believe that the mountains came because of the changes that took place during the earth. During the time of the flood, there was great tectonic activity, and there was a great time of mountain building. And this is talked about in many geological books, and it's called the Pleistocene Epoch. In the Pleistocene Epoch, the Rocky Mountains were built. And I've got some other theories about mountain building, but generally, to answer your question, I don't believe there was very many mountains during the time of Adam. I believe that those were a product of the flood and that they brought the rain and the changes in the hydrologic cycle and all these other things we're talking about. Well, I've enjoyed very much presenting this presentation to you. And like I say, I'm going to be up here taking this information down, so come up and take a look at it. I'll take it down in about 10 minutes, and then I will be outside to answer any questions that anybody else has. Thank you.